is a new book, the author Walter Korb, Indispensable Enemies, subtitled The Politics of Misrule in America, published by the Saturday Review Press. I think the book is a very important book, Walter. It's sort of a little bit of shame that it couldn't have gone to press about a year later and we could have had a final section on Watergate, but certainly the many of the things that you write about are applicable to the what we might say the mess the Republican Party is in at the moment. You do have a chapter on both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Seems to me your whole book reminds me of something called aesthetic realism, where the law of opposites rule, that when something is good, something has to be bad, and when something is bad, something has to be good. I think the part that I associate myself with mainly is the fact that the two parties really are one and the same, which you talk about, and that they're more interested in the status quo than in many cases of electing officials that will help the American public or the economy or the climate or anything else. And you, I think, point out every possible one in every city and every major thing that's happened that I remember in our political history. You go all the way back. Some of the most glaring ones, of course, are the Chicago situation with Daley, the Jersey City with Haig, here in New York and the various mayoralty races, Joe Clark in Philadelphia. Who have I left out that you talk about in
David Cargo in New Mexico.
Yes, that's right.
The Republican.
Yeah. And what we're talking about is that when, in many cases, the regular party will cut their own candidate or openly campaign for the other candidate if it means that they will lose control if that party is, if that particular candidate is elected. One case which I hadn't known about historically, right here in New York State, which we might start about talking about, was the Sulzer case. That was a very interesting case way back about 50 or 60 years ago when Tammany took a part in this man that was elected for a very short term as governor. Perhaps we could start talking about that. Do you remember that?
Yes, it was a glaring and kind of pleasant grotesquery. Sulzer was a liberal Democratic congressman from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And in 1912, which was the great age of reform, anti-machine sentiment, Charles Murphy, who was the boss of the city, Democratic boss, decided he needed a kind of nice, friendly liberal as the candidate for governor, who was almost certain to win because the Republicans were then split between Republicans and Teddy Roosevelt, the Progressive Party candidates. Well, no one thought much of it because Sulzer was considered a friend of Tammany Hall, not likely to do anything to hurt them. So they put up Sulzer, and he wins. And all through the campaign, Sulzer was attacking machine, you know, bosses, including Charlie Murphy, who nominated him. No one ever thought, I think Alan Evans said it was, thought it would, when he became governor, would be a paper sword and shield fight between him and his good friend Murphy. But Sulzer surprised everybody when the legislature put up a very measly and rather fake primary law, primary election law to hurt party power. Sulzer vetoed it. That brought a shock. Then, when things got hot, Sulzer, instead of caving in as he was supposed to, started going around the state to rally support for his programs, which was unpleasing to Murphy or the Republicans. At that point, Charlie Murphy said he's got to show Sulzer, the governor, who's boss, and his minions in the state legislature simply had him impeached on some minor peccadillo. So I called in my book Non-Lethal Assassination. The interesting thing about that is that it's an example, a very rare example of party bosses choosing somebody and making a mistake. Usually when they nominate a man, they know him very, very well. Sulzer surprised them, he really did, and they assassinated him, you know, legally.
Well, it's very easy to follow this sort of logic in Indispensable Enemies. It's perhaps a little bit more obscure when you take a case of Goldwater and draw parallels with McGovern, that the national organizations, you say, allowed this to happen so that they could get all this out of the way and retain complete control. It was my feeling from covering both of these conventions that the organizations really didn't have much to say at the time, that both in the old saying that McGovern and Goldwater had the votes, so that maybe my point is that maybe the organizations really didn't have much choice at that time, and they were just figuring, well, these guys are going to lose and we'll keep control. But you say it was all sort of a predetermined plan on the part of the old guard in both parties.
Well, predetermined plan is a little too strong, because the Republican oligarchy didn't invent Barry Goldwater, and they didn't inspirit him with his presidential ambitions. However, party organizations do not joke and do not play. I mean, and they don't go to sleep, and they don't get taken unawares, because they think about nothing else except nominations. That's the most crucial.
And control,
nominating the people who are trustworthy from their point of view. I didn't discuss the Goldwater candidacy. I just threw it in as a kind of analogy to the McGovern candidacy. But I did point out several things, but party organizations don't let anybody steal nominations without a kind of fight you would see every day in every way. I mean, they, no holds are barred when they have an enemy, a real enemy, aspiring for the nomination. Now, it doesn't happen that often, but when it does, you know it. I pointed out that, for one thing, that McGovern, whose reputation as a reformer came entirely from being on the Reform Commission of the Democratic Party, was nominated for that Reform Commission by the old guard, which controlled...
But that didn't mean they wanted him as president.
No, that's the first thing. The first thing they did was make sure he had a Reform reputation. Now, why would they even give a Reform reputation to an enemy? They just, as I said in my book, people don't put weapons in the hands of their real enemies. That's the first thing. Now, all through McGovern's bid for the nomination, no obstacle was put in his way. New Hampshire was very, very interesting. It was obviously a crucial state in a symbolic sense, very crucial. In 1968, McCarthy's showing there unseated the president. Well, now, if they really were worried about McGovern, just wanted to put him out, after all, allegedly, he's an insurgent and an enemy of the party bosses. There are lots of things they could have done, which they did do. The first thing, of course, is to put up another liberal to split his vote. That's such a standard practice, because there were liberals around who wanted to run for president. Fred Harris.
John Lindsay.
And Harold Hughes. Harris and Hughes just never got any money to campaign, which is always a sign that party bosses are not, you know...
Yeah, but aren't you leaving out the fact about Harris, that Harris was earmarked to be dumped completely? They wouldn't even let him have his nomination for the Senate.
Yeah, Harris was earmarked
to be dumped completely. So, I mean, they weren't interested in putting him up for president when they were dumping him for senator.
I wasn't saying putting Harris up for president. I'm just saying if McGovern was the man to stop, and obviously he was the only, at that time, anyone on the field, you could have encourage somebody to get in there. Harold Hughes, all right. If you say Fred Harris was already killed by the party bosses, I'll accept that. And John Lindsay. Instead, in New Hampshire, where they had Mills was a candidate. Sam Yorty was a candidate. These were meaningless candidacies, but each one was supposed to take 2-3 percentage points away from Muskie. As if Muskie is supposed to be the man, he should be protected. And if McGovern is the enemy, he's supposed to have people to split his vote. It didn't happen at all. And not only that, but everyone said that Muskie was destroyed in New Hampshire, though I don't... And that McGovern had a great victory.
Yeah, but Muskie destroyed himself. It wasn't the bosses that destroyed Muskie. Weren't the bosses largely in his camp? Wasn't it sort of like a Romney situation where they were all on the Muskie, figuring Muskie had it? And they weren't too worried about McGovern.
Well, I don't see why they should not be worried. They were worried about everybody. I think they were worried about McGovern. I'm just pointing out that there was no obstacle put in the way of McGovern. One example was New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a place where he might make a showing. After all, McCarthy had made a good showing there in 1968. And it's a place where you launch a serious nomination bid. They didn't put up any kind of liberal, like John Lindsay. He stayed out of that state.
Well, I think that most of the poor people we're talking about considered Lindsay a much bigger enemy than McGovern.
Maybe. But there it is. There was no one in New Hampshire mm-hmm. to hurt McGovern. Also, there was nothing. When Muskie fell apart, which I think you're quite right, he fell apart.
He committed suicide.
Yeah, he was, as a friend of mine says, someone you couldn't take out into the sunlight.
We don't like crying candidates. I mean, that's what it really boils down to.
Oh, yeah, the party bosses didn't arrange his tears. No,
yeah.
I'm not saying that. But the point is, when he fell, now consider the situation. If you understand party politics, you understand a dangerous, an insurgent is so dangerous to them on the national scene. Even if he doesn't win the nomination, he brings people into the party. He raises issues they don't raise. He breaks up so many arrangements.
Grassroots.
Right. He breaks up so many easy arrangements. He wakes up people in suburban towns who haven't looked at the Democratic Party in 35 years.
They're still paying Bradley Stevenson in 1952.
That's right. He broke up the whole system in California by arousing grassroots support in California. For years, the California Party was nothing until Stevenson's candidacy, California Democratic Party. Well, in any event, as I said, they don't joke and play with people like who allegedly have the role that McGovern does. Now, the other things they did, they showed no signs of enmity. I gave you the New Hampshire example. Other examples were they didn't prop up Muskie at all. I mean, they let the trade unions did not refuse to endorse Muskie and get behind him, which was very, very significant, very interesting. If they were really desperately trying to put over their man as against a dangerous insurgent, the party bosses don't allow the trade unions to just go wander off in every direction. That's one thing they did. The trade unions didn't endorse Muskie. They now look back, they say they made a mistake, but it wasn't a mistake. It was quite intentional. The next thing they did was allow that old war horse, Hubert Humphrey, who, believe me, does nothing without an okay from the old guard, the regulars of the party, to come in and hurt whom? Not McGovern, Muskie, to cut him in half, in fact. And the interesting thing, the real interesting turn of events was that Humphrey, belatedly, started to do fairly well. And at that point, he had no more money. His money dried up. His big backers, those famous friends of Hubert Humphrey, no more money. He had hardly any money to campaign in in California against McGovern. He had no money to campaign in New York State, which is extraordinary. So I said that I concluded from those things that McGovern was not an enemy of the party bosses. They may not have nominated him per se, but they made it easy for him to win the nomination himself. Perhaps if Muskie had done better from the start in New Hampshire, they just would have let it go along because it would have served their purposes equally well.
And then they dumped him.
Yes. After they won the nomination, they distinctly and absolutely worked to defeat
him.
Cut
the national ticket.
Cut the top of the ticket, which was McGovern.
And then you prove this by the fact of the tremendous landslide and yet the very small turnover in the Senate and the Congress, which is a phenomenal result. I mean, this shows ticket cutting on the part of the organization and on the part of the various people in the
States. Absolutely.
Now, I more or less go along with you on that. However, when we get to the Kennedy situation, that Kennedy really didn't want his program. Again, we're talking about the opposites. He really didn't want his programs to go through. I think a lot of people would say that after Kennedy was elected, that the thesis that you put out is certainly open to argument, that he really didn't want to put through the legislation he was trying so hard, which ended up with Johnson putting through.
Yes, that's what I said.
Can we talk about that?
I took most of my facts, interestingly enough, from Tom Wicker's book on JFK and LBJ. The first half, which is on Kennedy, describes, is called How Kennedy Lost Congress. And the only difference between my view and Kennedy and Wicker's is that Wicker wonders why John F. Kennedy made so many blunders. And I just say he did it deliberately, and I point out all the actions, which are quite deliberate. The issue, he lost Congress, according to Wicker and myself, when he put up a federal aid to school construction bill. That was one of his two pieces of must legislation. And thereafter worked he and his administration and John McCormick to make sure it could not possibly pass.
Walter, if I can come in for just a moment, when you say he lost Congress in your book, Indispensable, as a result of this one piece of legislation, I think we all know that a president's relationship to Congress is different on all sorts of legislation. If he gets defeated on one bill, this doesn't mean that he's going to go down the drain on everything.
No, it wasn't my phrase. It was Tom Wicker's phrase.
Well, I mean, Tom was here last week, but I'm not going to argue about what he said. But I'm talking about what you say, because you use his terms.
Yes. Well, it lost Congress meant that thereafter he was able to say that Southern Bourbons and Republican Coalition was too strong for him to do, for example, initiate civil rights legislation or to carry out any larger program of reform, which would, quote, get the country moving again.
But he why said, would he say this?
Why did he do it? Well, first, we haven't established that he did it.
Right.
Which is a long and circumstantial argument about the school construction bill, which was an effort to demonstrate what, in fact, he said, and administration people said right at the start, as soon as he was inaugurated, that conservative forces are very powerful in the country and in Congress. He then went ahead and put up a school construction bill, and the first thing he did was have his Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Ribicoff, Senator Ribicoff, inject the religious issue. Of all possible issues, he said, Ribicoff, who had just been appointed by Kennedy, asked that the school construction bill include aid to parochial schools. Now, of all possible things for the first Catholic president of the United States to stay away from, it's an unprecedented federal aid to parochial schools. Then Kennedy made some sort of speech saying he was not interested in federal aid to parochial schools, and everybody said, he just had Ribicoff raise the issue of parochial schools in order to show that he was not bowing to the church or something like that. The next move was very interesting. John McCormick, Speaker of the House, then rallied the Catholic clergy, the bishops. He brought them to Washington to fight for federal aid to parochial schools. Now, the Catholic bishops, I mean, they had not asked the year before for federal aid to parochial schools when the bill had come up originally. Federal aid to parochial schools is just not unconstitutional, and the Catholic clergy is very cautious. So here's John McCormick, a man from Kennedy's own state, you know, with a fellow Catholic who's now going to push the Catholic Church, the Catholic hierarchy, to start campaigning, you know, start a letter campaign to force Democratic congressmen to insist on a federal aid bill, which is going to kill the bill, because every conservative, everyone who doesn't want federal aid to schools, can always stand on a constitutional argument and say, we're not going to vote for a bill that has federal aid to parochial schools. You just wrap yourself around the Constitution and that Constitution around you, and you kill it. Well, then there are a few other steps along in the way where Kennedy then changed his mind and said there had to be a federal aid to parochial schools, and the bill was dead. Not only that, but it died, in fact, in the House Rules Committee when one man, a Democratic congressman from Queens named Delaney, voted against the administration.
And Catholic, of course.
And Catholic, voted against one of the administration bills. It got rather complicated. And everybody said, how come a fellow Irish Catholic machine politician, you know, like Kennedy and Delaney, how could this powerful administration with its Irish mafia lose one vote in the House Rules Committee? The answer is they weren't trying to get that vote. That's my answer. In any event, it's a this kind of what I was a kind of an elaborate scheme for defeating your own bill. It just seems to be indubitable that he did it, because it's inexplicable why a person would carry out those acts or let John McCormick, who's hardly a rebel and hardly a man who embarrasses presidents, he never did in his life embarrass a president. Why would he embarrass his one president from his own home state?
But, Walter, why didn't he want to do it?
Why didn't he want to do it? Well, that goes back to the larger question that I raised at the beginning. Proposition I had set forth in about party politics. I had said that party organizations cannot maintain their power when the citizenry is active, when it enters into politics, when it puts its oar in. And that occurs when people have hope, when things are being done, when inequities are being corrected, when things that seem to be natural abuses like foul air and filthy streets are suddenly seem to be curable. That raising of hope, and therefore increasing the political activity of the citizenry, is something which endangers party bosses and party organizations.
Now, but why would Kennedy worry about endangering party bosses at this point? He's president. He's holding a lot of power. He's in. Why does he care about the party bosses at that point?
Well, that's a very good question. The party bosses nominated him, and they knew the kind of man he was. The kind of man he was, I think, was somebody who
they could play ball with.
They can play ball with. First of all, who they knew was not interested in reform and never was interested in reform.
No, he did business with Daley and Haig.
Yes, entirely so. The party organizations nominate at the presidential level. They don't nominate a man who they dictate to, you know, in their ear. They nominate a man they who they know and understand.
A man
they
can
trust.
Call on the telephone and ask for a contract.
Right, and more than that, they a man whose general political outlook they know and is the kind of political outlook they prefer.
Would you compare?
Kennedy was interested in foreign affairs. That's what he was really interested.
They
in.
Let him have that.
They let him have.
Would
foreign
you
affairs.
Compare that aura with that of big business and Nixon? That they would give him unlimited funds because they knew they could do business with Nixon, just as the party bosses knew they could do business with Kennedy.
Well, all parties raise fortunes when they're winning. I mean,
yeah, but there's never been anything like what Nixon came up with his money, to end up with millions in surplus and so forth, and to go around to all the corporations get anything they asked for.
Well, what Nixon's people did was to do more systematic, carry out that fundraising, which I call a shakedown in my book, yeah. Now that the president of American Airlines agrees, more systematically, you know, more thoroughly than has ever been
done
before.
But isn't that a parallel that big business could do with Nixon what the party bosses could have expected to do on the domestic scene with Kennedy?
Well, in effect, yeah, I suppose so. They thought he was a friend. But not in some cases, businessmen are very precise about profits and losses. I mean, those are specific favors they're looking for, or specific bills they want to see killed, or in some cases, specific legal problems they've been in they want to see quashed. So it isn't just a general aura that Nixon is a Republican or Nixon is pro-big business. Because in 1964, Lyndon Johnson got a tremendous amount of money from big corporations. I think the reason is that they knew who was going to win, so they sided with the winner. 1964 was the year the Republicans were walking away from Goldwater, so the money went to the winner.
Well, that was the comparison again between Goldwater and McGovern.
Right.
Walter Karp, we have about 5 minutes left. I think one of the most interesting parts of Indispensable Enemies is the Johnson situation as regarding the war, what he inherited from Kennedy and so forth. And you state that while Johnson was mouthing all these things about keeping us out of war, which incidentally you go all the way back to Woodrow Wilson and FDR and so forth in the book, there's an awful lot to talk about in the book, but specifically, Johnson already had the blueprints set, not on a planning basis, but on an operational basis.
By 1964, he had arranged all the necessary ingredients for launching an attack on North Vietnam, or what he couldn't consider the necessary ingredients.
But you say specifically, not on a planning basis, but on a basis of putting them into operation.
Yes, he had the Air Force, you know, located in the right Air Force bases. He had the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, you know, to give him carte blanche. He had a whole series of secret provocations of the North Vietnamese to sort of make to sort of engrave on people's minds that they're the real enemy. And larger than a contingency matter. Those are real
right.
things. There was a secret problem.
Well, where I don't agree is that you, and correct me if I'm quoting the book wrong, you state that one of the main reasons he does this so that he doesn't have to put through all the domestic reforms that he said he was going to do.
I said he launched the war in Vietnam in order to stop the Great Society, yes.
Right. Well, now why? Why?
I mean, why does a president who is known to be opposed to almost every reform, that as a majority leader of the Senate, get chosen by the party bosses to do the same thing as president? He just did what he always did. I mean, he was president now. He'd never been a reformer to begin with. Why should he be a reformer now? The specific thing is, if you start carrying out reforms, the president of the United States starts carrying out reforms that no one expects him to, he suddenly finds himself in a new world. His friends are now his enemies.
Yeah, but didn't he put through more liberal legislation than anybody else, even in spite of the war?
I don't know if he put through more liberal legislation than anybody else, no. He put through several months of legislation. Some of it was very dubious. The poverty program was an entirely dubious program. To this minute, no one seriously questions it. The educational thing, Head Start, is another dubious program.
What about the civil rights?
Now, the civil rights legislation was forced upon him by the citizenry, by a movement, a powerful movement going on for years. And as Evans and Novak pointed out, in 1964, when they passed the first civil rights bill, major bill, Johnson thought that would hold the civil rights movement, that would stop it, satisfy it, but it kept going on from strength to strength. and there was a Selma, Alabama business, and his hand was forced. There's a difference between what a president, what any politician does, and what he feels he's compelled to do. The civil rights legislation is compulsory.
One last question, Walter. Where do you draw the line, and how do you draw the line between that statement you just made, between when after he's done it, what he's forced to do and what he wants to do? Where do you draw that line?
It's a difficult line to draw. You have to judge it.
And how
in
can
every
you draw
case.
That line?
How can you? Well, you have to discuss the particular case, you know, the particular man and the particular situation.
It seems to me that you don't give any president any points for having any good motives regarding the American people.
Well, I never make statements like there is no American president who had, you know,
yeah, but where in your book did you ever say FDR did this because he believed in it, or LBJ did this because he believed in it, or JFK did this because he believed in it?
Well, I pointed out that Roosevelt established the National Recovery Act, which created the...
He had to do it. He was
forced. No. That, I said quite distinctly, was a vision he had of the country, one in which the great corporations would be formed into cartels and they would have governing powers. That he believed in. He genuinely and truly believed in it. I said that.
What about JFK did with U.S. Steel in the middle of the night and those other things? I mean, those were not things that he was forced to, you know, when he was stopping the price rises.
I didn't discuss
the, I know it's not in the book,
situation.
I'm just saying.
No, I didn't. I just never made a proposition about presidents doing no good unless someone has a gun to their heads.
Walter, I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I certainly hardly recommend the book, but one has to ask these questions. The book is Indispensable Enemies, The Politics of Misrule in America, published by Saturday Review Press. Thanks very much for coming by, and good luck on it.
Thank you.